Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt and taxes and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, with a love of fantasy books and funk, and a hatred of running more than 3 miles, Dave Denniston.
My name is Dave Denniston, your host, and welcome back to the latest episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Well, welcome back, my friends, to our monthly fireside chat with a physician to get to know their journey, their joys, and their struggles with finances and outside of finances. This show is not always about actionable content. It is, however, a chance for you to see behind the curtains, to walk in another person's shoes, to experience their lives. Now, our next guest, he is not only a physician, but he is also exploring this question. What else am I besides a doctor? Where more value can I add to the world? Now, a little bit of bio. He is a practicing full-time board-certified trauma surgeon. And even on top of that, he's a fellow podcaster. And even on top of that, he is a New York Knicks fanatic. But I must add, he is not a fan of Phil Jackson.
Hell no.
But even more, he has a passion for a whole life insurance. No, just kidding. He doesn't, but we'll talk more about that and his experience with it. But beyond all of that, he has a passion beyond medicine. He is breaking outside the barriers, and I know he has a ton of wisdom to share with us. And with no further ado, please help me welcome Dr. Nee Darko, the doc outside the box. Welcome, Nee.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me on the show. Sorry to interrupt your intro, but that's how much I don't like Phil Jackson. I'm a big-time New York Knicks fan, fanatic since, you know, the early 90s. So, you know, I speak up when I can about the Knicks.
Well, you know, you were back in the Sprewell days. Oh, you know, yeah. You guys accepted him after he started choking people out.
Yeah, well, you know, he got us to the finals, so, you know, all is forgiven, right? But but I was a fan even before then. I was a fan when, you know, during the early Patrick Ewing years, you know, John Starks, those years. That's when, you know, those are the true memories that I have. But obviously when Sprewell and Allen Houston and, you know, some of the others, you know, they were able to get to the finals and they got thoroughly whooped by Tim Duncan. I was a fan then also.
Well, you know, it's so funny. You do podcasts, and when you listen to other people's podcasts and then you actually get a chance to speak with them, it's like, man, I've been talking to this guy all the time. You just don't know it, man.
You feel like you have a natural connection, right?
I know, right? So I'm so glad you're here with us to share with everyone who may not be familiar with your podcast, Docs Outside the Box. So we're going to link it in the show notes. And as you know, this podcast, it's about empowering physicians with knowledge, how they can slash their debt, slash their taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle. And I know that financial knowledge for you, as I follow your show, is something that you've been acquiring through what I like to call the school of hard knocks. So before we get to that, let's just take a step back into the past for a second. First, tell us a little bit about you. Where'd you grow up? Outside of, we know it was New York, but what was your childhood like?
So I grew up in New York, grew up in Queens, New York, and then we moved to a city right outside of right outside of Newark, New Jersey, called Irvington, New Jersey. But my childhood was fun. It was great, very diverse. I grew up, like I said, in Queens, New York. In a place called Lefrak City, right across from Shea Stadium. So I was a huge Mets fan. I remember when Mookie Wilson hit that base hit, and I remember, you know, everybody in the housing complex that I lived was going crazy, and you can see the lights and the fireworks, you know, coming from Shea Stadium, and you know, those type of memories always, you know, stay true to me, or you know, they'll always stay with me. So sports was a big deal in my life just because we lived so close to where the Mets were. I never grew up a Yankees fan just because the Yankees weren't that good in the 80s. Excuse me. So I've always been a Mets fan. And then obviously I'm a Knicks fan and I love the Giants and Jets. But then afterwards we moved to New Jersey. We moved to a little bit outside of Newark, New Jersey. And for me, I have three older sisters. The youngest of them is a nurse and now is a nurse anesthetist. So I just remember just being, you know, just the youngest one causing problems, having fun. You know, my childhood was great. I really have fond memories. And it's interesting because I felt like, you know, I just had this natural dichotomy in my life. So I was raised in a African house hold, basically. My parents were from Ghana, West Africa, and, you know, just kind of having that upbringing, and then, you know, you're juxtaposing, you know, their American lifestyle with that. So at home, I'm eating, you know, Ghanaian food and African food, and then go to school and you work, go to school with a dashiki on, or, you know, go to school, you know, with, you know, funny looking clothes, you know, to people here. It was very interesting, obviously, having a name that stood out. You know, back then I really wasn't very proud of my name, but now obviously, you know, very extremely proud of my name because of, you know, it, there likens and harkens to a certain history with my name, which, you know, some people really don't have. So for me, I'm very proud of my name now, but it's very interesting to kind of talk back and think about my childhood and the natural transition that I had from, you know, just being very awkward and not understanding why certain things are in my life to now I'm very proud of those things. And it's just weird how that works out.
Well, it's in hearing you talk, a couple things that just struck me as we were chatting here. I'm a West Coast guy, grew up in California. And the perception out on the West Coast, you know, we think of East Coast people as being more aggressive, maybe more competitive. As
forget
as
about
you.
It.
Love it. All right, right, yeah. Right. Love it. Loving their sports.
Get out of my way. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking in relation to growing up and academics and those kinds of things. Was it a really competitive environment? Is that a fair description of kind of the place you grew up, not just across the bay from Manhattan, or what was that like?
No, it wasn't a competitive environment, but it was, I just remember like the lifestyle or what happened outside of where we lived. You know, basically you can just describe where we lived was the projects. So where we lived and where we grew up outside our apartment door was very different than what happened inside the door, you know? So my parents were very, you know, very lucky to have two parents in the household. Education was always pushed very hard in my family. My three older sisters protected me from everything that went on outside. So, you know, although there was a lot of ills and a lot of negativity that went on outside of the door where we lived, you know, I was really protected by my sisters and I was really protected by my mother and my father. And education was always pressed in our household. We always had a certain level of confidence just because we just knew that there was a certain level of expectation that our parents had on us. There was a certain level of expectation that I knew I had to keep up. And what was going on outside of where we lived, you know, even though it's a level of circumstance, not everybody in the projects is downtrodden or, you know, held in a negative light. You know, obviously, you know, we didn't fit that description, you know, but, you know, we knew that we wanted to get out of there. I knew I wanted to get out of there. And I knew early on that education was the way out. So for me, it wasn't a competitive environment, but just more of just you have a lot to live up for. There's a lot of expectations on you. There's a lot of responsibility on you. And, you know, I always embraced it. I never had any stress from it. And it really helped me kind of transition from where we were in New York and where we grew up in Newark to, you know, where I am now. And it's the reason why I continue to push myself, because I know where I came from. And I know that if I can come from that, you know, and continue to succeed, there's really no stopping me. So,
well, what's so beautiful about that? I mean, it's the American dream, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, coming overseas and here you are, first generation American, because you were born here, correct?
Not yeah, I was born here.
Ghana. And so as I think about someone doing that, I mean, that, to me, that's just amazing for one. But when I think about money, obviously it was hard for your parents to get going here and obviously they did the right things and look at you now being a physician. Was money something that they talked about a lot or how did that play into growing up with you?
So for me, or at least in our household, money wasn't talked about too much, except my parents told us to save. That was the biggest financial lesson that we had. Save your money. That's it. You know, no, we didn't get the, you know, you can save your money and then maybe start investing. I didn't really understand investing. We didn't talk about that. But I do remember every now and then that there would be some moments where, you know, the lack of money became very palpable in the household. Just leave it at that. There was one time, like in the late 80s, during a stock market crash, my father lost his job afterwards. And I remember it was a very scary, tense time. And although I don't know the specifics of the financials of my father at that time, I just remember it being a very tense time in the house. Everybody was very nervous. I remember my mother telling me, you know, you can't be playing around like crazy outside because we don't have health insurance. So if you got hurt, you know, you got to be really careful with what you do. So that was a very nerve-wracking time. And I also remember just, you know, things like my father would get a car and he would come home and, you know, we have an okay car, but I remember my father not feeling very proud of the interaction that he had at the car dealership. Things like that always just kind of resonated. My parents are my heroes, and I think the experiences that I remember are things that, you know, when they went through situations and I can see that they weren't too happy about that, those things kind of ring with me. So I always knew that financially I wanted to make sure that I got into a profession where finances wouldn't be too much of an issue, or if it was, I really had control of that situation because, you know, finances, obviously, in certain parts of my memory and certain parts of my childhood, you know, was a very important time, or was played a very pivotal role for me. So besides just saving our money, we really didn't get the lessons of trying to make our money work for us. And that's something that I think is just as important as just saving your money, obviously. Understanding that money can work for you in various ways, whether you're sleeping, whether it's working passively, I think that's just as important as obviously living within your means and saving your money.
Well, one thing that popped up for me as you were talking about these stories of your parents scraping by, and is that something, if you don't mind me asking, that you are planning for, you know, to help your parents live comfortably after all the sacrifices that they've made for you?
Oh, absolutely. I'm standing on their shoulders. I would not be in the situation that I am right now without them. It's funny, I still go to my parents for advice, even though, you know, I am far exceeded what they've ever made in terms of income. I still go to my dad for advice on cars, advice on what should I do financially with this or financially with that. And they're very important to me. And as a result, financially, both me and my wife, we feel in debt, basically, in a good way, though, to our parents. And it's a sense or a source of pride to be able to financially be able to provide for them in their later years. So for me, I don't look at it as a, you know, some people may look at it as a burden. But for me, it's a sense of pride to be able to do that, because I look at it, I'm like, well, they were able to take care of me on literally a quarter of what I make right now, maybe even less than that. You know, without any complaints. And granted, they had to do that. So with what I make and what me and my wife make, and eventually, hopefully, you know, if things continue to flourish with what I want to do, shouldn't be a problem to at least provide some sort of support to them.
Well, I got to imagine, I mean, that's motivation, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, yeah, that probably helps keep you going in medicine. And I would like to take a step back, Nee, for a second. When we look back at your growing up young in across New Jersey, and you're there with your parents, you're this wild, crazy, fun kid. At what point did you know you wanted to be a doctor? Tell us about that journey.
So I've been, you know, it's funny because this was something probably maybe 5-10 years ago, something that I was really proud to tell people about, but, and I'm still proud of it now, but it just rings a different bell. So for me, I watched a lot of TV when I was younger, not too crazy like today's youth do, but you know, I watched TV and I was influenced by what I saw on TV. So for me, the consistent person who was on TV, who was African American, held in a positive light, had a great wife, beautiful wife who was a lawyer, wonderful children, lived in Brooklyn, had a brownstone, was what? The Cosby Show. And he was a doctor, right? So, and he was an OB doctor. So for me, that's something that I looked forward to every Thursday. And, you know, I had during that time also sports figures who I wanted to be like. My father also, I wanted to be like, was an engineer. So those were some of the top three things that I really was interested in doing, which was, you know, I wanted to be an engineer. At one point, I wanted to be an athlete. But if you've ever seen me or if you see a picture of me, you'll know why I'm not an athlete. I'm 5'10", you know, 160 pounds. So, you know, besides track and field, that's as far as I'm going to be able to go athletic wise. And obviously being a physician. And for me, I just kind of glamorized in my mind that lifestyle of a physician. I was like, okay, well, you know, I can get a wife like Claire Huxtable, and I can have kids like, you know, like he has, and I can live in Brooklyn in a brownstone and have a practice in my basement, or go to the hospital and have a practice. So it was something that was what it, that that imagery resonated with me, even at a young age. And up until, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think what's so so beautiful about that, I mean, even we don't know what really happened behind the scenes, obviously, but
right.
Nonetheless, I mean, to inspire people like that, I think is just amazing. Mm-hmm. And here you are, a young kid watching the show, enjoying it, being entertained, and it impacts your life.
Absolutely.
So did you start shadowing doctors when you were like in high school, or you know, when did you start making more and more of a commitment outside of watching the show to so, being in medicine?
So it's interesting. So I got accepted to Lehigh University, and they had this pre-matriculation program for people from certain areas to come and at least check out the school and take some classes before school actually started, just to get used to the campus. So I decided to go, and at a picnic I met this physician who worked, he was a trauma surgeon who worked in Newark, and he was an alumni of the school. We talked, and he invited me to spend a couple of times or a couple of shifts with him at University Hospital in Newark, New Jersey, which was at the time maybe about 5 blocks from my house. So I went there, and I remember vividly the first night my parents dropped me off. He was waiting out in the intake area where all of the ambulances come. My parents talked to him for maybe about 5 to 10 minutes. They left, and me and Dr. Garrison were talking. And literally within 5 minutes, an ambulance pulled up. Like, all of these alarms kind of went off in the hospital. And he's like, look, we got to go.
Wow.
And then he came and he put me in a corner. And this is, I'm 17 years old. So I'm getting ready to go into freshman year of college, by the way. So I'm 17 years old. You know, I get put in a corner, and it's just like chaos of nurses, med students, residents, just medical professionals going around this one patient. And this kid couldn't have been more than, I don't know, my age. So 17, he's screaming. Someone's checking his blood pressure. You know, this guy's screaming in pain. Someone's giving him pain medications. IV fluids are going in. All these different things are going on that literally at 17, I don't know what's going on. But to me, it was almost like this chaos, but chorus at some point almost. And Dr. Garrison is on the other opposite side, the opposite corner. And he's just like directing this almost like a maestro. And it's amazing. Like, he's the conductor, just, you know, just saying, you do this, you do that. No, no, no. Go here, go there. And eventually, you know, within, I don't know, to me, it seemed like 10 minutes, but it was probably quicker than that. They whisk him off to surgery. You know, obviously at that age, I had no type of orientation. I couldn't go up to the OR, but roughly about 2 hours later, he came back down, and he's giving the mother of this patient, you know, a hug and letting him know that he's going to be okay. And he's speaking all of the stuff that I don't understand, but you know, the mom just gives him the biggest hug. And when I'm watching this, I'm like, that's exactly what I want to do. He's the person I want to be like.
Wow.
And from that time on, I just knew that I wanted to do trauma surgery. I knew I wanted to go into surgery and do that type of lifestyle. And it's funny. The previous experience to that was being an obstetrical doc, right, from the Cosby Show. So I kind of struggled with that in med school, and I kept an open mind. But then eventually I just started gravitating to general surgery, and my experience in rural Kansas really changed and really solidified my thought process that I wanted to be a general surgeon. And then from there, the rest is history. I just did rotations in general surgery, and then I did my residency in general surgery, and then I kind of just gravitated, being in Atlanta, towards trauma surgery, and that's where I am now.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Here you are from the East Coast. You go to Kansas, of all places.
Oh, yeah.
So in terms of lifestyle, in terms of money, when I think of Kansas, I think of extremely low cost, whereas mm-hmm. East Coast, I think both coasts as being very expensive. What was that like, you know, being in Kansas for you? Was it a culture shock? How did money play into that?
So look, let me be honest with you. So thinking about going to Kansas from New York, from New Jersey, you know, I'm a typical New York City prick. You know, like, I think everything revolves around being in New York and New Jersey. So I'm like, well, going out to Kansas, what's out there? You know, the world stops as soon as I pass the George Washington Bridge, or, you know, go past the Poconos or something like that. And being out in Kansas was one of the best experiences of my life, actually. I met my, you know, then was my study partner, but now is my wife. And I've met some friends who I still have long lasting relationships with, but it really was a complete culture shock. And not in terms of diversity at all, because actually Kansas City is very diverse. Kansas City is one of the, you know, as you know about the southern migration of African Americans from the south to the north heading towards Chicago, you know, one of the places that they stopped at was Kansas City. And then obviously there's other cultures there. So it's very diverse, actually. But just in terms of just the Midwest lifestyle was just a culture shock to me. But it was one of the best experiences I've ever had. Got to meet people from way different walks of life from me, people who were raised on a farm, people who, you know, have never, who consider Kansas City the biggest city that they've been in, you know, where for me, Kansas City is like a suburb, you know, you know, meeting people from different countries, you know, who are here just for med school. It was a phenomenal moment. And then for me, college, I struggled with, just because I just couldn't really understand like biochemistry because it just wasn't explained in my terms. So, you know, if you can understand biochemistry in terms of like the Krebs cycle and all these different things, that's great. But in medical school, they teach it to you like, well, when someone has diabetes, this is what happens during a Krebs cycle. And you're like, oh, that makes sense. Now I get it. So in med school, I got to study everything that I always wanted to really know. And for me, it really wasn't that hard in medical school for me because I was really invigorated. I was really excited to study what I have always wanted to do. So besides the culture shock, it was just a great experience. I'm going back for my 10-year reunion in October, so I can't wait. I haven't been back in 10 years. But
get some barbecue.
Barbecue, you know what I'm saying? Gates barbecue, you know? And I just can't wait. It was great, though. It was great.
How interesting. Well, now you've gone to medical school, and you're in residency now. And I jokingly mentioned in the intro how much you love whole life insurance.
Man, don't get me started on that, please.
Well, I want to know about this. So tell me about your experiences. How did this start out?
With what? With whole life or just with the School of Hard Knocks?
How did you run into it in the first place?
All right. So this is how it happened. So basically around my fifth year, someone came and bought us lunch during the lunchtime of, you know, around lunchtime during residency. And I was a chief at that time. And the guy came and talked to us about, you know, how important it is to shore up our assets and to shore up all these different things. You got everybody who's listening to this, they know what I'm talking about. You know exactly what I'm talking about. So I gave the guy my phone number. He called me and we had some follow-up and then we talked at a coffee shop and he got me to sign up for, you know, life insurance as well as for disability insurance. Okay. And I believe what I signed up. Go ahead.
So let me just read. So it was a seminar that this gentleman had in your residency program. So this wasn't medical school. This was your last year in residency.
Yeah. If you want to call it a seminar, I mean, he paid for lunch and then he kind of just started talking about stuff and, you know, no, and come on, nobody's really listening, right? You're like, what, you bought Chick-fil-A? You know, so you come and we're eating the food and then he starts talking to us about stuff and you're like, all right, I guess I'll listen to what you have to say. And so I gave him my phone number and we followed up and that's how it started.
Now, do you think that was this someone, because I find that a lot of residency programs, for example, they have an existing relationship with, like, let's say, Guardian, and there's basically people from Guardian that circle the residency programs or other companies. Was that your experience? Was it someone that basically?
No. It was some, they brought, this guy, he's a nice guy. He knew what he was talking about. Nice guy represented what's the word? I guess it's almost like an advisory firm. And he came by and I guess he talked to him and said, look, I'll buy lunch if you give me access to your residence, basically. And, that's what he did. And then from there, he explained to me, you know, asset protection and understanding why I needed life insurance and disability insurance. And to be honest with you, I can't remember if he was pushing term versus pushing term and whole life. I can't remember if he was pushing both.
Well, let's just explain to people that maybe they're residents or they're medical students and they're listening. What's your perception of what is term, what is whole life? What is that?
Right. So for me, at that time, I didn't understand. But term basically is you have insurance for a set period of time. Most of it is what? 10, 15, or 25, or even 30 years, and then that's it. After that amount of years, you don't have any insurance after that. Whereas whole life, you have basically insurance for life, and you end up paying a certain premium to basically keep up that insurance. And depending on how much depth you want me to go into, I mean, there's components of that whole life insurance that is called a death benefit, and then there's also a portion of it that's called a cash value component also. And depending on, you know, how in depth you want me to go, basically your premium is going to end up paying for the death benefit as well as for the cash value benefit. And in terms of the differences between term life and whole life, you know, term life is a lot cheaper than cash value just because of the added components and the added advantages that you're seeing in cash value, or excuse me, in a whole life. So
now I want to know, you mentioned you got both disability and whole life insurance. So when you get to this point of figuring out, I'm assuming you're in practice at this particular point, that's like, oh God, this policy sucks. I'm paying 10 times what I should be paying for this. What did you do?
So actually I was, so what happened is I got life insurance and disability insurance in Atlanta. And then, you know, I was finishing up my chief year, and then I went down to Miami and I went to a party, and, you know, party's going off like crazy. You know, having a good time. And I bump into this guy, and we just start chatting and stuff, and he finds out that I'm a physician. And then he starts asking about insurance. And literally, as I'm getting the drink from the bartender, I roll my eyes. And I'm like, oh, Lord, another insurance agent. And he's like, look, tell me what you got. And we just started chatting real quick. And he's like, take my phone number. And I guess I should have never did that. But let's leave it to you like this. He ended up convincing me. And I guess you can kind of figure out, I'm very easy to convince. He ended up convincing me that basically the type of insurance plan that I had before, whether it's life and disability, I ended up basically replacing that with the plan that he had after about five or six meetings at my resident or at fellowship in Miami. We ended up I ended up changing it up and getting something that was even more expensive. It was a combination of term life and whole life. It was also disability. And, you know, it was manageable as a fellow. But then what happened is we continued to increase my plan as, you know, my income went up. So once I finished my fellowship and started doing locum tenens and then eventually had my job in Pennsylvania, I increased my, you know, the amount that I was putting in towards it dramatically. I went as far as, you know, talking to my other friends who were physicians and giving him their name, and he started connecting with them also. And then after a while, what me and my wife started noticing is that we couldn't pay our loans. We couldn't make an appreciable amount towards our loans because the majority of our money was going towards life and disability. And then let's talk about, you know, the pink price tag. I don't know if you ever discussed that on your podcast, but, you know, my wife, you know, was paying way more in disability than I was, close to about $700 a month. And, you know, for an unknown reason, basically. So that just caused a huge amount of concern. So we talked to him and said, listen, first of all, he didn't meet with us after we got married to discuss, well, maybe there has to be some type of change in the amount of coverage that they need since they've been married. That didn't occur. And then we started talking to him like, look, I think we need to pare down how much we're paying into these plans because, you know, to be honest with you, we're not able to make appreciable payments towards loans. And his answer to us or his advice to us was, no, I think you guys should leave the plan alone, but I think you guys should budget better. That call was made over, or that answer they gave to us was over speakerphone. And basically, wow, if you could like have a movie scene where literally it was just literally this eerie, you know, awkward, you know, like silence. And then the look that me and my wife had, it was literally like a someone done told this guy wrong moment. We were like, okay, fine. And I basically at that moment, everything that I was telling you before earlier in the podcast of feeling like I was being taken advantage of for myself was something that I kind of related to how my father felt. And at that moment I was like, never again. So I said, thank you very much for helping us. That's okay. and we hung up the phone. We didn't make any decisions to move away from everything, but at that moment, I said, I will never, ever feel like this again. I am the only one who cares about my money. Between me and my wife, we're the only ones who care about our money more than we do. And that's when, literally, the School of Hard Knocks started, and I just went on internet searches. I found a white coat investor. I found all of these different things that I was like, if I had known about these people online, if I had known about these YouTube videos, I would have found out about this a lot earlier, and I would have gotten myself out of trouble or not even walked into this situation. And, you know, I was looking out of anger because I was very upset. And that's how everything kind of got started. And that's how I started acquiring knowledge, realizing that I can kind of do this on my own. I started realizing that the person that I was working with, there's different tiers in which planners are being paid and so forth. And it was a very enlightening experience. It was something that I needed. Let's leave it to you like that. And it really helped me and my wife kind of realize that rather than handing over our finances to someone and saying, hey, you handle it, that it has to be more of a let's work together in this situation. What's your advice type of situation? Because I still believe, me and my wife still believe, and I think most physicians still believe, there is a strong need for financial advisors. But I think from a physician standpoint, we have to look back and internalize and think, what is it that we can do to make this process a lot easier? What is it that we can do to make sure that we don't ever fall into the potholes that people like me, you know, like Dr. Darko had fallen into, or people who are still not awake right now are still going through right now, where they may be paying for products that they may not need, or not fully understanding, you know, the products that they bought. What can we do to make sure that we don't go into the, get into that situation?
So if you're talking to a knee that's is his fifth year of residency, and you were going to warn him about this experience or just tell him about advisors, what would you advise him to do?
I think the first thing I would tell him to do is just relax, take a deep breath, and just go on the internet and just look up this information. Because I think nowadays, you know, obviously over the past 10, 15 years with the explosion of the internet, with just Google search, you can look up anything. You can go to YouTube and look up anything. And I'm not saying that you're going to acquire enough knowledge to do things on your own, but I think you can kind of understand and get at least a simple, basic understanding of the plans that are being pushed to you. And like I said, the first experience that I had, the one in residency, I don't think that was a bad plan that was put towards me. But I didn't fully understand it. And, you know, I don't think that he needs to break down everything for me, because I think in life we don't really have that. When we go and we buy, you know, whatever we may buy from a store or buy something from a mechanic, or even when we go to see our physician doesn't tell us every detail of everything that happens. Part of that responsibility falls on us to educate ourselves, to understand the specifics of the product that we're buying. So part of the blame, I think, definitely I put on my shoulder, that I needed to better understand it. So that's one of the biggest pieces of advice I would give to myself, is just make sure that you relax, just read up on this information first, find out if you really need it. So for me at that point, you know, was it even necessary for me to get life insurance? At that point, I wasn't married. I don't have kids. I did have a plenty amount of debt, but yeah. Was it really necessary to have life insurance at that moment? So that's probably the biggest piece of advice I would give to myself at that moment. It was just to just do more of an education, do more of take more effort into reading, whether it's, you know, going to the library or going online and reading more about, you know, the different products that are out there. And then also at the same time, you know, understanding my finances better, understanding budgeting. That's a big deal. Like, I didn't understand budgeting. I did mental math so that I wouldn't overdraft at the end of the month. But that's elementary. That's preschool, you know.
Totally.
The amount of budgeting.
Let me point something out real quick for everyone who may not understand how this kind of works. So insurance are a commission product. And a person may tell you, oh, I get paid through the company, you're not paying me directly. But as a matter of fact, they are getting paid, and it is coming out of your money, because a lot of these products have these long surrender schedules. So they're keeping your money captive, essentially, in order to pay the agent for the most part. So I would just warn everyone, be careful of that. Asking the question, how is your advisor getting paid, as Nee brought up, is a great question to ask. Now, besides insurance,
can I just, you know, it gets worse though, right?
Tell me about it. Talk to me.
So I'm telling you, I am learning through the school of hard knocks. So just really quickly, we find another advisor. I don't ask, you know, what type of planner he is, if he's, you know, commission based or what have you. But basically, I tell him about my experience with the other, with the previous planner or with the previous advisor who's, you know, got me into these huge, you know, cash value plans. And just, you know, silver lining, I was able to get at least 90% of my money back, actually. So that was the silver lining. And we got the majority of our money back and we put it into our loans. So the surrender value wasn't too bad on that one. This new advisor actually said I was abused by the previous person. Okay. Said I was abused by the previous person. Said that cash value life insurance is not as bad as I think it is, but I was abused. He sold it to me wrong and got me and my wife into another cash value plan with higher surrender values.
Mm.
So now it's, look, now it's to the point where, look, I was just stupid for doing it, right? So after a year, we just said, this is stupid. We literally have wasted close to about $2,500 each. And because the surrender value was so high, we couldn't get any of our money back. So it's just gone. And wow. That was it. That was the liberating moment. I just said, look, I have spent way too much money literally letting someone guide me blindly through this process. It will never happen again. So that's why when people hear me on different podcasts or people read some of my posts, I am so staunchly opposed to cash value. Part of it is an emotional, visceral reaction that I have for me being so stupid for going into that again, but also at the same time not educating myself about it. But, you know, look, I'm not going to say that cash value, all cash value plans are bad, but you have to understand that there are very, you know, specific moments or very specific reasons or rationales for when you need it. And I think, at least from a young, graduating, newly minted attending, I don't think that they really qualify for that. It's not really necessary.
Well, you know, I think it really comes down to where they're at. I mean, I guess if you're a neurosurgeon and had all your student loans already paid off because your family helped you through your residency program, and it could be worth thinking about, but I don't know. I think it's a very rare instance for most physicians where a lot of people I talk to have $300K in student debt. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. But sorry for interrupting you on that one. I just wanted to let you guys know that, you know, I was making some really dumb mistakes. So please use me as the cautionary tale.
That's right. Well, I think that the main tale here is be aware of what you're getting into to the best of your ability. You're not going to know everything about it, as Nee said, but I think the lesson is just double check, get a second opinion, just as many regular folks would do with physicians. Doesn't hurt to get someone that may be doing the opposite and why, and see what sits with you the best. Now, besides insurance, let's get off that soapbox. You mentioned this.
Let's bring my blood pressure.
I know that. Let's bring it down. Put a little cooling pad on your head here. I know that debt is a huge subject and something we talk about a ton in this podcast, because it's something that I see practicing physicians still 20 years out of practice struggling with. So for you, how has debt been part of your journey? And then secondly, what are you doing to address that debt?
Ooh-wee. All right. So like I said, I met my wife in med school. We didn't get any scholarships going into medical school, and we went to a private medical school. So I graduated with roughly about $240 of debt. We also got our MBAs, and then she also graduated the same amount of debt. We got married roughly about 3 years ago. But when we graduated from medical school, we had $240 in debt. We couldn't make any substantial payments during residency, so a lot of interest accrued. So by the time we got married, we roughly each had about $330 in debt. So right now, we found ourselves, as of November of 2013, in $660,000 in debt.
Wow.
And $130,000 of it was in private loans with interest rates that range from 6% to roughly about 10%. And then the rest were all consolidated during that special time in 2002, 2003, 2004, when you could consolidate your loans at a very low interest rate. So we were lucky within that realm. But debt has played a very big role in our lives. As you can see, I'm an East Coaster. I'm from New York. My wife is from New York, but we are in Pennsylvania. We found a great job in Pennsylvania, but if the world was perfect, we'd like to be closer to our family in New Jersey and New York. But because of the fact that the lifestyle is so high, because property taxes, state income taxes are so high, we can't afford to live in New York or New Jersey. So we live about 5 hours away in rural Pennsylvania. And it's been a great experience for us out here. The job is great. Our employer is great. The pay is good. We are able to keep the majority of our money and use that towards loans. So on average, what we do now is we live off of one salary, which is my wife's. She works part-time as an OB doc. We live off of her salary, and we use whatever's left from her salary, and then we use all of my salary to pay off student loans. And we started that process in October 2014, and we are roughly about 60% of the way, maybe even more, towards our loan debt, finishing it all
Congratulations,
off.
Congratulations, man. I'd clap, but I don't want to hurt anyone's ears at the microphone. People sort of clapping out here, but that's amazing. Well, yeah. I know one of the things you talk about the podcast is you're actually purposely not buying a house.
We already have a house.
You did buy a house. Okay,
no, you were delaying
on it though, right?
No. We don't have a house. I'm just joking. Like, we literally have now.
The mortgage
is, we basically equate our Sally Mae loan debt to a mortgage. You know, so it's a joke. It's just a play on words. So we kind of look at it as if we have a house right now that we're trying to pay off. But yes, we've been delaying purchasing a house. We've been delaying on purchasing anything long term until we get our student loan debt paid off. We are basically practicing everything that we can to make sure that lifestyle creep does not happen. And I'm sure, Dave, you see that a lot in some of your clients, or just, you know, some of the bad stories that you hear about physicians who, you know, are in student loan debt or are in a situation where they just, there's a big jump from being a resident to being an attending. And all of a sudden you think you deserve a house and you think you deserve the Tesla, or you think you deserve what have you. And then all of a sudden you're living paycheck to paycheck, and you look back and you're like, wait, I'm a physician. How am I living paycheck to paycheck? You know, so
yes,
it's very interesting how that works out. But that we've done everything we can to make sure that we don't fall into that trap.
Well, on my end, it's so hard because, I mean, you can't tell people what to do. I mean, at the end, people are going to do what they're going to do. And you think of living on the coast, as you said. I mean, if someone chooses to live in an area where homes cost $600,000, $700,000, $800,000, $900,000, and they're still working off of debt, and in many cases, there's good reasons to do that because they have kids and they need family support, or they have a great possibility of a job there because they know people and have connections. But gosh, I just what I see a lot of physicians struggling with is they're 50 years old, they still have $100,000 in student loans. And they have a fat mortgage, they have a car loan, they might even have a little bit of credit card debt. And when you look at what they're spending, they're never going to be able to retire by the time they're 65.
No.
And as hard as they've been working, as many sacrifices as they've given to the world, I mean, it breaks my heart in many ways, but you just have got to work with what you got. Some people learn those lessons later rather than sooner.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I think the great news as a physician, with the way things stand right now, despite reimbursements being on the decline and everything, is you still have a chance to make this up. You know, we're not done yet. There's many ways to do it. And one of the things, I guess, that leads us to being outside the box. You are the doc outside the box. Or at least you're working on getting outside the box. And So tell us about how the podcast started. What inspired you with that?
So the podcast started, or at least the idea for the podcast started, when I was doing locum tenens after fellowship. I had a hard time figuring out where I wanted to be in terms of practicing. Obviously, I knew that being in New York and New Jersey wasn't possible, but it's very hard to determine where you want to end up based off of an 8-hour interview. So, yeah, you do an 8-hour interview at a hospital, and then they give you a contract. Yeah, sign this 3-year or 5-year contract. And, you know, for me, it's just like, that didn't sound very appealing. So I started doing locum tenens. And What locum tenens is, if for people who don't know, it's basically temp work for physicians. You go to different hospitals, they may have a physician shortage in a certain specialty, and you go there and you work there for a certain period of time, a week, 2 weeks, 3 months, 6 months, maybe even longer. And you work there and you basically get to see what it's like to be a physician in that situation. And what I noticed is I would go to different hospitals. I would work in Pennsylvania, Minnesota. I'd work in Idaho, various different places. And I was meeting different physicians who, you know, were in various parts of their career, whether, you know, early on, in the middle of their career, or at, you know, towards the end. But they were doing some really phenomenal things. I was meeting people who were, you know, doing things, you know, they were, most of the time they were in Liberia or in very austere environments with, you know, Doctors Without Borders, and they were using locums within the United States to kind of help pay for that time that they weren't going to get paid. There were people who were medical experts for CBS. There were people who were just doing really cool, crazy things that I always wanted to do, but never got a chance to do. So picture me, I always had a lot of things that I was very interested in. I was very interested in computers. I started a computer tech company with my father. I was very interested in sports. And I noticed in med school, I really liked connecting and talking to people. I was really big into student organizations and just talking to people. And I realized that I just like doing those things. And because of having to focus on residency and focus on this tough lifestyle, I just let all of that stuff fall by the wayside. And I started looking back on things and I'm like, look, since I was in high school, basically I've always thought 4 years in advance, right? So freshman year, what's life going to be like? Even as a high schooler, what's life going to be in college? And then you get to college. Look, I'm trying to get through these 4 years of college so that I can get into med school. And then after that, residency. Then after that, you become an attending. And then it's...
Now what?
Now what? And for me, the whole notion of, okay, so now I'm going to spend the next 20 to 30 years just operating and taking care of patients. And that is very noble. And that's what I would like to do, but I just needed something else. There has to be something else that comes along with this. And that's how Docs Outside the Box started. It was me saying, okay, this is my foray. This is my thing where I'm going to just introduce everybody to all of these interesting stories and basically find inspiration for people who are looking to do things outside of just normal traditional medicine. And with me, I try to give career advice. I try to find guests who are relatable. I try to find guests who are still humble, who are still going through the grind, that my listeners can relate to them and say, huh, maybe I can be a media expert, or huh, maybe I can move to New Zealand, or huh, maybe I can, you know, do X, Y, and Z and do that. And one of the biggest things that I don't like about some podcasts, particularly even some of my favorite podcasts, are they would interview people who are so successful, who are so far away from the grind, that they're talking about things that I can't relate to. You know, like, for example, like listening to like Tony Robbins, he's amazing, right? He's a great speaker. But when, you know, he's giving financial advice and what it's like to grind and stuff, I'm like, dude, when's the last time you grinded? You know, like, you know, like when you have the guy who owns Virgin Airlines, I forget what his name,
Richard Branson.
Richard Branson. And he's talking about, you know, my life is, you know, I live on an island and a beach, and it's like, I can't identify with you anymore, really. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's not for everybody. So for me, I've always wanted to make sure that I get physicians, or I'm talking to people who are really able to give people actionable advice or actionable gems, and also who can relay a sense of relatability. And so far, you know, I've had nothing but great guests. I've had nothing but great feedback. It's been an amazing journey. It was something that I was scared to start. It took me about a year to get started. I'm still scared to do it now, but I'm getting more comfortable with it. And yeah, that's my show. I mean, you can catch it on docsotb.com, docsotb.com. And I hope some of your listeners take a listen and become subscribers.
No, they'll love it. I mean, I think to get specific stories and seeing people that maybe have made it, which I think is great about your show, as well as people that haven't made it yet. They're still figuring it out as they go. And one of the things that I am passionate about as we go along this journey is this whole idea that I hear all the time from physicians: I wish I had gotten this business education when I was in medical school.
Absolutely. You know,
yeah. No one ever taught me this stuff. And so for someone that's listening out there, and they're feeling burned out, maybe they're feeling like they just need a change because they've been working so doggone hard at medicine for years and years and years, whether it was their residency or whatever, and they're thinking about wanting to do something on the side, a little side hustle to get going. You're doing this now with the podcast. Can you let people know, you know, what is it like as a physician where you're doing this side hustle? Let them behind the curtains and give them a little business education on what that's like for you.
Right. So I think much like your personal expenses, what you do on the side is a business, basically. But with, for example, with our personal expenses, we budget out what we're going to spend on a monthly basis. The same thing has to occur with your side business or with your side hustle. So I know on average, although I don't have any advertising yet, I know that I spend a certain amount of money for editing. And that's pretty much it. That's my biggest expense. So I have to make sure that I stay within the budget. And, you know, for me, the biggest thing is I work a 24-hour off schedule. So it's a lot of back and forth. So I know that a lot of my workflow has to occur during the time when I'm off. And that's helped me to become so efficient that if I didn't work within that realm, I don't know if I'd be as efficient, because for 24 hours, I know that, you know, I'm going to be post-call, I'm going to be tired, so I know I need to get a good nap in, but I know that there's a good 6 to 8 hours where I am on and I got to get as much work in as possible. I have to email guests, I have to confirm dates, I have to make sure my equipment is okay, I have to, you know, talk to website designers. I have to do so many different things just to kind of make sure that the show continues to move forward. But for me, it's so easy because this is my passion. This is what I love to do. Eventually, when the show gets bigger, I'm sure I'm going to need some help, but I really, truly love doing this. Like, you contacted me and you wanted me to talk about, you know, my thoughts and being on the show. Like, this is what I love doing. Like, I live in Pennsylvania, but I'm visiting family, but I'm sitting in the basement in Long Island doing this interview using my phone to tether. Like, this is how it works, man. You know, it's like, it's tape, you know, it's duct tape, you know, and it's not going to be perfect. And that's what I want people to understand. Like, you're going to jump off the cliff, you know, not, you know, literally, but when you decide to take a leap, you're going to have to do a leap of faith, and you may fall a little bit and you may cut yourself on the side of the rocks and stuff, but eventually you're going to learn to fly. It's not going to be perfect. And the key is...
Well, let me...
Go ahead.
Let me just back up just a second, because I was just thinking I want to insert something so people understand. So you talked about the cost of someone editing, but there's also other costs that people should be aware of that you do, like having the website, buying the domain, the hosting, if you have a separate email, all those different things are costs that people can do. My wife has a band, and you know, it's a loss leader for us. So it's a little bit of a business write-off, but you can minimize some of those things as you go about it, which I know you've done a great job of. And at this particular point where you're grinding and you're getting leadership, in the space, and you're getting more listeners, and you don't have revenue really to speak of yet, how are you thinking of trying to get that first bit of revenue? What does that look like for you?
So for me, the what's been the pie in the sky, I guess, or what my eye is on right now, is trying to get some advertising on the website. So if you come to my website, you'll see that it's very generic, very simple right now. So what I'm working on doing is redoing the website so that I can have a little bit of some advertising, whatever the company may be, just on the side, so that I can start at least breaking even on a episode by episode basis. Right now it costs me roughly about $40, realistically about $50 or $60 per episode to come out with, and that's not including the cost of a domain like Dave you spoke about, and actually hosting also. So I would like to get to the point where I am breaking even or even making just a little bit of a profit. So the way how I see it is, as my Twitter following goes up, as the downloads go up, which they've been doing on a monthly basis, once I get to a point where I feel very comfortable with that, I'll actually contact companies and ask them about sponsorship packages and start that process of actually inserting, you know, some of their advertising onto my website.
I think I have one for you.
Oh, yeah?
Guardian Life Insurance Company.
Okay.
Selling whole life.
Yeah, they could be on the back page, actually.
they could be a commercial at the very end after 30 seconds after you finished with the podcast.
$5,000 a second.
Well, let me just say, Ben, I mean, to do what you do, to find the time to be a practicing physician, to run a podcast, it's like two full-time jobs, and obviously you're passionate about it, and that just amazes me. So I just want to say, I think you're doing something really special. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you for all you're doing, man. And just tell us a little bit more about the podcast in terms of people go to your website. What do you think are some of the most popular episodes you think folks should check out?
Well, thank you very much for saying that, because this is really a labor of love right now. So to be able to get some good feedback, some positive encouragement and affirmation is great. So thank you, Dave, for that. So yes, if you want to if you go to my website, DocsOTB, so DocsOTB as in boy.com, you'll find all the episodes. You could also find us on iTunes, find me on Google Play, as well as Stitcher Radio, Docs Outside the Box. But in terms of asking me what are my favorite episodes, you're going to get me in trouble by saying this.
Your wife hasn't been on yet, so it's okay.
No, she hasn't been on. But right now, I only have 10 episodes. So right now, I really truly think that there's tons of knowledge and gems that listeners can gain from. So for example, like if you want to live outside the box, and that's it, like you just want to live outside the box, you want to do something different, but you don't want the limelight, you don't want the fame, then I think episode one is a great episode for you, because you can learn how to live in New Zealand and practice medicine, right? If you want to learn how to, let's say, leverage your knowledge to get the lifestyle that you want, including being a public speaker, being a media expert, if you just want to get your swag on in public, then episode two is for you. That's where I have Dr. Dre, or Dreon Birch, who's America's OB-GYN. That's a great episode for you to listen to if you're trying to... Sorry, episode three. I apologize. Episode three is his episode. That's if you want to live outside the box and kind of have more of a national...
concierge practice, right?
Yeah, and he has his own concierge practice where you know, he's taking care of the gynecologic issues of high-profile people. So it's very interesting what he has. But I won't... Just take a listen to his episode. I think you'll like it. But if you're, let's say, for example, you are looking for, this is one of my favorite ones. If you're looking to start a nonprofit, you want to live outside the box and you want to take care of a solution, whatever it may be. Episode five, I have, Dr. Cameron Matthews and Alden Landry. Episode five is a good one where they started a nonprofit that goes around. They get funding from the Army, they get funding from Aetna and from various sources, and they get on a bus, they get a bunch of physicians to come with them, and they go to different high schools and different colleges, and they help people from less advantaged backgrounds and from minority areas, and they teach them the process of applying to medical school. You know, so that's episode five. If you want to get your finances in order, you know, let's be honest, like if you want to have a non-traditional type of lifestyle, like you have to get your finances shored up, then, you know, episode four is a good one. That's with Katie Brewer. She's a fee-only financial advisor, as well as episode six. That's where I interview Jim Dolly, who created the White Coat Investor, the website. Those are great episodes for you. So I think there's something for everybody there. In terms of my favorite, I can't say yet what's my favorite. I could tell you what I've had a lot of fun talking with. I think episode five, I had a lot of fun talking with them because I was actually friends with them. I still am friends with them. And to see them grow something from an idea that they had in medical school to something that is getting so much national attention, it was amazing. And that was a fun interview. But if you're looking to get anything, any type of knowledge about living outside the box, I think all of the episodes, all 10 episodes will be of value to you.
Well, man, you just keep on doing what you're doing. You step outside that box and keep at it, because I think it's a really great podcast that physicians will really enjoy once they get into it. Now, as we wrap up the interview, I like to start asking this question nowadays. So I want you to just to take a step back into the past. And you're not a practicing physician. You're not even a resident. You're in medical school. So, Nee, if you could sit down with a younger Nee, a Nee that's about to finish medical school, what advice would you give to him?
don't freak out, but in 5 years, you're going to lose your hair. No, but what I would say to the little me, because back then I did have a full head of hair, you know, the first thing I would tell myself is to relax. Everything's going to be okay. You know, for me, I was so worried about what the next step would be that I didn't really stop to smell the roses. I didn't really stop to really appreciate the process of being a medical student, of just being, you know, being a med student. Do you know what I'm saying? Like just understanding and being cool with where I am without really just kind of just worrying about what's going to happen over the next 5 to 10 years. So I would have told myself to just chill, smell the roses, understand that, you know, spending more time with family and friends is just as important as being a very good student. So having balance would be another piece of advice I would give myself. And obviously the second thing that I would teach myself also is just to spend more time just teaching myself just the basics of budgeting, the basics of investing. You know, that's another piece of advice I would tell myself is just, you know, understand just the basics. You don't need to know everything, little knee, you know, just understand a little bit of the basics and don't be afraid to touch these products. I think the biggest, or the second biggest piece of advice I would give myself, which would be number three, would be, you know, to embrace social media more. Back then, I was a very private person, but I would come back and tell myself, listen, there are ways that you can embrace social media without letting everybody have, you know, a window into your private world. You can still let people kind of know you and you can introduce yourself to the world without giving everybody every small little tidbit about your life and stuff. So I would tell myself, look, social media is about to blow up, you know, mm-hmm. be one of the first, you know, an early adopters of this and be open to the experience of living outside the box more also.
Awesome. Very good. Great advice. Well, thank you so much for being with us. And if people have more questions, how can they get in contact with you?
If you want to get in contact with me, there's multiple ways to get in contact with me. You can contact me through Twitter, which will be at DocsOTB. Remember, that's D as in dog, O-C-S-O-T-B, B as in boy. I also have a Facebook page, which is Docs Outside the Box. And then also, you can email me at DocsOTB@gmail.com. I respond to all of my emails. I respond to everything that I get on Facebook. I respond to everything I get on Twitter. So there's always a way to be in contact with me and to have a relationship with me online.
All right, man. Well, go get it and keep at it. And if you're listening, my friends out there, I would love the chance to tell your story. It would be my honor to host you on the next podcast because I know, just like from Knee's journey, that we can learn from it. We can help other physicians. After all, who better to speak to a physician than another physician? So I think Knee really laid out some great ideas, some great thoughts for us today. And if you are interested, definitely contact me, dave@drfreedompodcast.com or on my website, www.drfreedompodcast.com. For the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, this is Dave Denniston. Remember, my friends, remember to slash your debt, slash your taxes, live a liberated lifestyle. Also, if you gain some value out of this podcast, I would be eternally grateful if you could just take 5 minutes of your time, review it on iTunes or Google Play, because the reviews help more and more physicians become aware of this podcast. Thanks so much for joining us. Make sure to subscribe. Check in again soon.